This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
So I've worked with giving advice on so many different subjects, all the way from radars to ocean measurements to fisheries to air quality. So I feel I've touched base with not only people in my field, but many different fields of human factors.
Since 1973, the Tyler Prize for Environmental Achievement has been bestowed upon people who have made a significant impact in the fight for a sustainable planet. In 2019, we spoke with that year's Tyler Prize laureate, Warren Washington, to learn about the beginnings of his groundbreaking career as an atmospheric scientist. This week on Sea Change Radio, we pay tribute to Dr. Washington, who recently passed away at the age of 88. He was the second African-American to receive a PhD in meteorology, a former chair of the National Science Board, and a senior scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. Then we revisit part of our conversation with physicist Hattie Carwell to learn about her long, illustrious career in the atomic energy space, as well as her work at the Museum of African American Technology. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Dr. Warren Washington. He's a distinguished scholar at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. Dr. Washington, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
Congratulations on receiving the Tyler Prize. It's quite an honor. So you were the second African-American to receive a PhD in meteorology, is that correct?
Yes.
Why don't you explain how you got into the field and what it meant being an African-American in Jim Crow America when you received your doctorate? What kind of challenges did you feel you had to overcome?
Well, I want to say a little bit first about my parents. My father graduated from a black school in Alabama, and its name is Talladega. And my mother went to University of Oregon. My parents encouraged me to get a college education. I had a great interest as a child in science. So I wanted to go to a school that had a physics program, and I wanted to be a physicist. And that's what I graduated in a bachelor's in physics. Then I started working on a master's, and turned out that a meteorologist was part of the department at the Oregon State University. And I worked as a radar operator, taking measurements from a mountain in Oregon, and I got more interested in meteorology. So I graduated with a master's degree in 1960. And in 1959, on a small group of scientists was working on trying to build a computer model of the atmosphere at Stanford Research Institute in Palo Alto, California. And they were looking for somebody who had a good mathematics background to come help do some of the calculations. So I got the opportunity to go to spending the summer in 59 with them. And at the end of the summer, I thought it was exciting that they were showing on the way to build the computer models.
And this was all white men, basically, running this thing.
And
or were there women in the group?
Oh, in the group it was all men.
All white?
All white. And I then ended up going to Penn State University in July of 1960. And it was a good experience for me because the faculty was very supportive of some of my ideas on building computer models and being able to analyze data on computers. And I ended up, after 3 years, I got my PhD, and I was looking for a place to begin my career. And openings became available at the newly opened National Center for Atmospheric Research, and I joined in September of 1963. As far as I know, I was the only African-American to be hired at that time, and certainly I was the second African-American to get a Ph.D.
And we've done several pieces on Sea Change Radio about the lack of diversity in the environmental movement. Maybe you can speak to the evolution you've seen, whether you find it encouraging or disheartening, in terms of diversity within atmospheric sciences and in science community at large.
Well, there were two aspects that had to be dealt with. We had, even in the 1960s and 1970s, we found that there was very few women in the field, but also African Americans, Hispanics, and Native Americans. So I spent a little bit of time visiting many of these pockets of where they had some students going to the schools in the southeast part of the U.S., in Atlanta, Jackson State, Alabama, and places like that. And I would meet some of these kids, and I would encourage them to look at science of the atmosphere and the oceans and other parts of the climate system to explore getting advanced degrees. I told them basically that they could do a lot better if they had higher degrees than just having bachelor's. The help of the American Meteorological Society, which has the forecasters as well as researchers in atmospheric science, became interested and wanted to increase the number of underrepresented minorities and women. And I headed up a effort which has now increased the representation of these underrepresented groups. And at the time that I first became active in 1970s, it was only two or three of us at the meetings, of the annual meetings. And now when we have an annual meeting, there can be well over 100 African Americans and Hispanics and Native Americans. And the women, our population has grown enormously. It's up to almost 40 or 50% in many of the graduate school programs of over 100 universities. So you can see a change was taking place.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking with Dr. Warren Washington, who is an atmospheric scientist and one of the recipients of this year's Tyler Prize for Environmental Achievement. So you've been appointed by six different presidents in your career to different posts. That's and a wide ranging. Maybe you can kind of give us a little bit more of a snapshot of some of your service.
Well, okay. On the first president that I had a presidential appointment with was Jimmy Carter, and he had as part of his advisory mechanism something called the National Committee of Oceans and Atmospheres. And it had to deal with fisheries research and the atmosphere and the oceans and so forth. And it gave advice mostly to NOAA, but also other science agencies. And it turned out at the end of my four-year term, I was reappointed for another term. So I served under President Reagan. Then I served as an advisor for the first President Bush, and then Clinton. Now, the Clinton one was an interesting one. I was appointed to the National Research Board, and it gave advice to the National Science Foundation, and I became chair of the National Science Board and served under the second President Bush. Obama, I gave advice to through the National Academy of Sciences and the National Academy of Engineering and Medicine. So I've worked with giving advice on so many different subjects, all the way from radars to ocean measurements to fisheries to air quality. So I feel I've touched base with not only people in my field, but many different fields of human factors.
Do you think that your chosen field of research has given you the ability to kind of stay above the political wranglings that accompany climate change? I mean, you've worked for all the presidents up through Obama, starting with Jimmy Carter, so three Democrats, three Republicans. Is it more of a function of your field of study or something else?
Well, I think it was our first desire was to try to build a model, a computer model of the atmosphere and then the ocean and then sea ice and then all the way to looking at the biological aspects, vegetation and so forth. So on the idea was to build a model that could be used for a whole bunch of different issues, looking at past climates and future climate. And somewhere in the time period of 1987, the Department of Energy became interested in what we were doing and wanted to help sponsor some use of the Department of Energy computers, supercomputers, on issues dealing with climate change. And so we joined with them as well as the National Science Foundation to start carrying out experiments on what happens when you increase carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. And that's always been part of our research. It was to first of all, build a model that is credible and as accurate as we could get it in those days. So, and with the limitations on computer capabilities, to use it to answer policy questions as well as legitimate research issues.
Dr. Warren Washington, thank you so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for interviewing me, and hopefully you can help convince people that climate change is a serious and important issue.
Yes, stars shining bright above you. Night breezes seem to whisper I love you. Birds singing in the sycamore trees, dream a little dream of me, yes. Say nighty night and kiss me. Just hold me tight and tell me you miss me. While I'm alone and blue as can be, dream a little dream of.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Hattie Carwell. She is a health physicist and the co-founder of the Museum of African American Technology. Hattie, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So what is a health physicist?
A health physicist is a physicist that primarily focuses on radiation safety and protection. Protection involves assuring that facilities that generate radiation are safe. There's no leakage to the environment. People working around equipment are not overexposed to radiation. There are programs in place following regulations set up by the state and federal government to ensure that the environment and people are safe.
And what is the Museum of African American Technology? And maybe kind of tell us the mission of the organization.
Well, the Museum of African American Technology, Science Village, is actually an archiver of the achievements of African Americans in science and engineering. Also, it presents seminars, exhibitions, and special programs, particularly targeted for students anywhere from age 6 till 84.
And when was it founded? And maybe kind of give us an idea of the growth and vision for where it's going.
The museum was actually founded in 2000, the year 2000, as an outgrowth of an exhibition that the Northern California Council of Black Professional Engineers sponsors. The exhibition was on George Washington Carver, and it was held at Jack London Square. As a result of the visitors to that exhibition, one of the founders of the Northern California Council of Black Professional Engineers indicated that he really enjoyed the exhibition and stated, wouldn't it be great if we could have this type of exhibition on an ongoing basis? I reminded him that for some years, the engineers had planned a museum, but had never gotten around to doing it. So he indicated that he would give some startup money. And as a result, the museum came into existence in July 2000.
So why don't you take us back to your journey? I'd like to hear, as an African-American woman who became a renowned physicist, why don't you kind of walk us through what challenges you faced and privileges you were afforded as a young woman?
Well, I'll start with the generation of my interest. I went to a segregated school. I went to the same school for 12 years.
Where was that?
In Ashland, Virginia, a very small town, population 3,000. And one of the things that always occurred at our school was science competitions. Individual students were selected to, I guess, accelerate their study in the sciences and compete in these competitions. And I liked them because I got to travel. And so I participated in those types of competitions from sixth grade through high school. And it was in the middle 60s, and much to my chagrin, I thought by the time I grew up, it would all be history and there would be nothing left to do. Big surprise, there was plenty left to do when I came out of high school and college.
So maybe you can talk about your family and its philosophy towards education, and how much of your educational journey was self-motivated and how much you were influenced by your family?
Well, I would say I've been influenced throughout life by my community, family, educators, and friends. First of all, I must say, I was raised by my aunt and uncle in Virginia. I was actually born in Brooklyn, New York. I was the middle child of 7. And my aunt and uncle had no children, and they offered to take me and raise me in Virginia. I maintained contact with my immediate family throughout that time. I would spend summers in New York with my brothers and sisters. But my first job was at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And I stayed there about 9 months. I got an offer at Brookhaven National Lab. So after 9 months, I moved from Thomas Jefferson to Brookhaven National Lab on Long Island in Upton, New York.
And so what did you do at Brookhaven?
I worked for the Atomic Energy Commission, providing oversight on the radiation program at Brookhaven, making sure that their design facilities were in compliance and also that they were in compliance with the federal and state regulations applying to them. After Brookhaven, I started at what was the San Francisco Operations Office, still as the Atomic Energy Commission. It later became the Oakland Operations Office for the U.S. Department of Energy.
So you moved out to the Bay Area in 73 or 4?
73, the fall of 73. I left the Bay Area, however, in 1980. I wanted to take a period of time to work for the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Commission. And there I worked as a nuclear safeguards inspector and later became a group leader with that organization. I was assigned facilities in Europe. So I went to various facilities throughout Europe that had signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which basically was a promise they would use radiation for peaceful purposes and not for clandestine purposes.
And then you returned to the Bay Area?
I returned to the Bay Area after 5 years of being in Vienna, Austria with the IAEA.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio, and I'm speaking to health physicist and the co-founder of the Museum of African American Technology, Hattie Carwell. So what kind of differences did you sense in terms of reactions to you? If you can kind of contrast Austria in the 80s versus Oakland in the 70s.
I would say being in Austria for those 5 years was probably the best time for me of my career. And I say that because, one, I was there representing the United States. They had great respect for the United States. I was protected because I carried an American passport and a laissez-passer, or let go, for the IAEA, meaning I was probably the safest in my lifetime and the most respected in my lifetime under those circumstances.
In terms of you had real high security clearance, et cetera?
Yes, I had a security clearance. But believe it or not, it could cause a global incident if I was offended in some way or something were to happen to me.
So people treated you?
Oh, I was very well treated. It was assumed by virtue of the fact that I was there that I was qualified. And so second guessing, can she do the job? Will she do the job? Traveling internationally is the best circumstances of my career.
Was it a little disheartening to come back to the United States and maybe not have that same status?
It was. It definitely was, because the conversation about the status of African Americans in the U.S. hadn't budged very much in 5 years. Many of the old problems and challenges still existed. And particular, since I had been gone for 5 years, I experienced the fact, some had forgotten that I existed because part, it's a privilege to work for the IAEA. You're seconded by your government to go there and work. And your agency is supposed to keep you informed of promotion opportunities while you're gone. And I didn't quite get that treatment while I was gone. There were several things that had happened in my division while I was gone that I know I would have applied for, but I wasn't told.
So Hattie, the only period we haven't really covered is 1985 to 2000. What did you do during that period?
Well, I came back and continued to work at the San Francisco Operations Office of the U.S. Department of Energy. However, to put in perspective, what I did when I returned was not to stop what I was doing while I was in Vienna and before going to Vienna. In 1977, I wrote a book on Blacks in Science. I had attended a conference, and I heard my first paper about the achievements of Black in Science, and I found it fascinating. And so I went to the libraries trying to find additional information, which was difficult to find. And so I ended up writing a book because I thought others would be just as fascinated as I had been.
So let's fast forward to today. After a career involved in either directly or tangentially to the nuclear industry, to see reactors around the country being put out of commission, how do you feel about the future of nuclear energy globally at this point?
Well, I've always been a supporter of nuclear energy as being part of the mix of energy options. In Europe, while I was there, France basically passed an initiative that more than 25% of their energy would be generated from nuclear. And I find the contrast interesting. The U.S. is supposed to be progressive, but they were lagging behind in terms of making such bold decisions. In fact, nuclear has had a mixed reception, even to today. And I would say if anything, be it significant or not, negative happened in nuclear, it would just put the last nail in the coffin.
Hattie Carwell, thank you so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Albert Collins and Louis Armstrong. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.